The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, thank you all for being here and practicing together. Thank you for those of you who are online participating as well. And looking at the camera that's there. I look at the camera and I imagine the people who are on the other side of the wires, the participating. And so thank you all. So I have this program that I teach, Introduction to Buddhist Chaplaincy, teaching people some basic skills in spiritual caregiving. And in that program, people have to read. There's a lot of things they do, but one of the things is they read these little stories from the ancient Buddhist texts that somehow are evocative of things that people who are doing spiritual caregiving should reflect on and think about and engage in, almost as if it's relevant for their work in hospitals or hospice or prisons, wherever they're doing their work. And then they have to write an essay about it, with the reflections, with the idea that living a reflective life and spending time thinking and taking a Dharma topic, a Dharma theme, Dharma teaching, and mulling it over, digesting it, reflecting on it, looking at different perspectives, is a very important part of spiritual caregiving, this ability to reflect and to learn from what we just did. So sometimes it's called action reflection in the spiritual caregiving world, where you do something, and then after you do it, you reflect on it. You don't just go on to the next thing, so you can learn from it. And people who do spiritual care, this is really important, because spiritual care comes with a lot of responsibility. You're working with people with tremendous suffering and challenges, and it's sometimes hard to be able to know how to meet people and support people in these circumstances. And so the idea is to develop a capacity to reflect and to think, were there other perspectives, or could I say it differently, or was this helpful, how was it helpful? And in the reflection, people will see it in new ways that they wouldn't if they just went on to the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing. And by reflecting in that way, then we learn, and then when we go to the next, future spiritual caregiving opportunities, we go wiser, we're more capable to tune in, figure out what's going on, and be supportive. So we give, part of the exercise we do is we give them these stories, and then they have to write their reflections on these stories. And that's what I did today, was to read those stories, read those reflections. So there, it's on my mind, one of them. So I want to share the story to you, and I'll say some words about it, and maybe some of you will have some reflections about it, or interpretations, or it evokes something that's interesting to look at. And usually when these people doing the chaplaincy training, when they write their reflections, one of the things we're training them to do is, and it's sometimes it's really hard, but it's really important, and that is, when they reflect on the stories, not to give their opinion. Some people, they just want to show you how wise they are, and they have really wise interpretations of it. But an interpretation of the story is not really the point, because then I know that they're wise, but they haven't learned anything. The idea is to stretch into new areas, like, what does this evoke? What about this story is challenging? How does it reflect on something I don't understand yet and what I don't know? So it kind of stretches them into new areas. So I'm not saying that you have to do that tonight, but you might want to keep this in mind, and because maybe after I finish what I do here, some of you will contribute something, some reflections about the story. The game for this? So the Buddha was living outside of a town called Savatthi, place where he often lived in his 45 years of being a Buddha. And I think he was probably fairly old then, because he didn't go along into town to get the morning alms. But the monks went in to get their morning food. They go for alms. They go walking the streets with a bowl. And people who want to feed the monastics will put food in the bowl. They bring them back to the monastery and eat it. But when they're in this town, it was actually kind of a capital city. There were a lot of different religious seekers, a lot of religious teachers, people who were pursuing the spiritual life, ascetics, they're sometimes called, wanderers, contemplatives, of different sects, different groups. And when the Buddhist monks went into town, they saw that all these other contemplatives, non-Buddhists, were living there, and they were spending an inordinate amount of time arguing about doctrines. And they were arguing on things like, the universe is eternal. No, it's not. Someday it'll come to an end. That'll be it. In the Indian context, that was not just an abstract idea, but it related to the idea of rebirth. Because if we're always going to be reborn and the universe is eternal, guess what? You will be eternal. Now, maybe that's a good idea for you, but you keep coming back over and over again. You have to do high school again and again and again. You know, so I don't know, maybe some of you had a great time in high school. But after, you know, there's just, you know, or all kinds of horrible things people have in their lives. And so after a while, the eternity of this coming back is not so interesting. But if the world's going to come to an end sometime, then what happens to you? You just disappear. And that, for some people, is not very interesting, very frightening. So they had these opinions. The world is eternal, the world is not. They were also interested in people who were fully enlightened. Do they get reborn, or do they not get reborn? And so there are a whole series of these, and scholars call these metaphysical ideas. There's no proof, you know, what is right, but people have opinions about them. And so people are arguing about this, and so the Buddhist monks saw these arguments going on, and they went back to the Buddha and explained what they saw. And the Buddha said, oh, these who are arguing about these points, they do not understand, they don't know how to understand or how to focus on what is beneficial and what is harmful. And so this might seem like a simple thing to say, but this represents a major distinction in the Buddha's teachings of avoiding all kinds of metaphysical questions about life, great existential issues about what happens with death, who are we, what's this world about, anything that's kind of these universal claims that many religions make. And instead of going along those lines, the Buddha is interested in something pragmatic and practical, which is here and now, to live a life, to understand how to live a life that brings benefit and avoids harm, a life that brings benefit to other people and avoids harming other people. One of the formulations of this idea is a life that brings kind of a reliable, lasting happiness, kind of a spiritual happiness, and avoids suffering, the freedom from suffering. So whether the world is eternal or not, that doesn't matter in deciding and choosing how to behave now, here and now, in ways that bring increasing benefit to us here and now, increasing happiness and peace and well-being. And avoiding harm, avoiding the things that bring increasing distress and stress and suffering. So this distinction is, when the Buddha said, oh, these people arguing in town, they don't know what's beneficial and they don't know what is harmful. The Buddha is also focusing in saying these two simple statements. Buddha has an idea that what you do is consequential, that you can make a difference for yourself in your own life and in the life of others to some degree. Your actions are meaningful. Your actions are important. It's the kind of actions that you do which affect whether you're going to be happy or unhappy. There's no guarantee that that's the way, but there's a tendency that if you do certain kinds of actions, you'll probably be less stressed out, more happy. If you do others, you probably feel less happy. If some of you are driving home tonight, and you decide that that the funnest thing possibly you could do is to drive absolutely as fast as you can down the freeway, and zip in and out of the traffic, and you don't care about the people who kind of veer off the freeway and fall into a ditch because, you know, it's fun to drive fast, and you know, and it's just kind of like fun to be all kind of, you know, revved up after meditating. And so who knows what happens to you? You get pulled over, you get arrested, you go to bed, you realize, oh, wait, you can't fall asleep because, wait a minute, those people were in the ditch in their car. I wonder what happened to them. And it just, you know, maybe it takes 10 years for your life to catch up to you, and you're, what did I do? Or maybe you feel right away what that was. Or, you know, so all kinds of ways you can drive, they're just stressful. Or you can drive home in a way that's safe for everyone, not just you, but for others. You can drive home generously. Someone, wants to come in front of you, and you clearly, you don't have to, because you have the right of way, and they could easily wait. But you're generous. You slow down, and they can get in easily and safely from the on-ramp. And you drive in a way that saves gas. You're using less gas maybe or something. And so you come home and your driving doesn't, something you feel good about. It doesn't make you feel bad particularly. And maybe you go to bed kind of happy about the acts of generosity you did. Maybe that example is kind of silly or trite or something, but it's the accumulation of those kinds of choices that add up over a long months, years, a lifetime to make a huge difference for our human heart. And to learn to become skilled at knowing what to do, what to say, how to live, to create the best possible conditions in the heart, what's beneficial, and avoid those which are stressful, is a part of the enterprise or the project of Buddhist spirituality. So when the Buddha said, those contemplatives in town don't understand what's beneficial and what's harmful, he was pointing to the actions they can do. He wasn't talking about what books they should read, what to watch, what to look on their computer, or, you know, they weren't consumers of spiritual life. In Buddhism, we're producers of it. And so we're the ones who have to at some point get involved in acting in different ways. So then the Buddha went on and he said, he told a story, kind of a fable. He said, long ago in this capital town there was a king. And he sent out his people to bring into the palace as many of the blind people that they could find in town. So they brought a whole slew of blind people in. And then he got one of the big royal elephants. And he had the blind people, each of them, go and touch a different part of the elephant. Some touched only the leg, one leg. That's all they could touch. Someone else touched the ears. Someone else touched the tusk. Someone else the big, what do they call that tusk? What is it called? The snout for an elephant. What are they called?
Trunk.
The elephant's in the front and the car's in the back. And so and someone else touched the tail, someone else touched the bushy hair, hairy tuft at the back of the tail. So they touched all these different parts. And then they were supposed to report what is an elephant? And so the person who touched, I'll read what it was supposed to be, what they said. So the ones who were shown the head of the elephant said, "The elephant, Your Majesty, is just like a water jar," like a big jug of water, I guess. Those who were shown the ear, who felt the ear, said, the elephant is just like a winnowing basket. Those who were shown the tusk said, it's just like an iron, rod. Those who touched the trunk said it was a pole of a plow. Those who touched the foot said it, or leg, said it was like a post. And those who did the hind quarters of the elephant said it was like a mortar. And those who touched the big kind of tail said it's like a pestle, mortar and pestle, kind of the butt and the tail. Those who are shown the tuft at the end of the tail, the elephant, Your Majesty, is like a broom. And then saying, the elephant is like this, it is not like that. The elephant is not like that, it's like this. The blind people argued and fought and struck one another with fists. So, and then it goes on to strange statements. This gratified the king. In the same way, monks, the wanderers of other sects, the other contemplatives, are blind. They don't know what is beneficial and what is harmful. They don't know what is the dharma and what is non-dharma. Not knowing what is beneficial and what is harmful, they live arguing, quarreling, and disputing, wounding one another with weapons of the mouth, saying, this is the truth, that is not the truth. So this is a very famous analogy, simile, the simile of the elephant and the blind people, with the idea that when each of those saw an accurate part of the elephant, but took the part for the whole, and then claimed they knew exactly what the whole was. They had the full picture from a partial perspective. And so, and for the Buddha, it seems that the full perspective is found by how we act, how we live our life, knowing what's beneficial and what's not, finding our way on our own, and not arguing. The big part of the Buddha's teachings was the pointlessness of arguing about these existential, metaphysical ideas. So here we have this idea of the blind men and the elephant, each of them seeing only a partial part of the truth and arguing over it. So what reflections do you have on this? What thoughts and ideas come to you around this story? Have you ever been this way? In what way is this an interesting mirror for yourself and your reflections? So, and you can, I'd like to hear some of your thoughts. And, or if you have questions about the story or anything you'd like to bring up, you're welcome to.
I think of our political parties, actually, and the fact that there are only two major political parties and the other ones exist tend just to be excluded. and what is maybe lost in that discussion.
Uh-huh. So politically, to argue about this is the right, this is wrong. Sometimes they're like blind people who see the only partially the partial story. So how do we how then do we open the sight so we can see more widely?
I would offer that you allow other voices into the mix. I would offer that you allow other people than two Democrats and Republicans into the conversation.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a wonderful idea you're saying, because with this story of the blind people, each of them had part of the truth, but they didn't have the whole. They needed each other to put together the idea of what was the complete picture of the elephant. And so life is a little bit of a teamwork. For any of us to think that we individually alone can know what the truth is and all kinds of areas of life is probably a bit of a delusion. But we need other people as well to help us understand and to broaden our perspective, open up so we get the bigger and bigger picture. And so that, I think, what you're suggesting. So talk to people who have opposing views, and there's an art to doing that. How do we have to listen to someone with opposing views if we're going to benefit from that conversation?
I think you start with things that you can agree on.
You start with what you can agree on? I'm sure there's other things that would be useful too, and that kind of one of them I'm thinking about is that you have to be willing to be changed. You have to listen with an open mind and to try to find your way. What in here is useful? What is maybe true and something, as opposed to sticking to your opinion, your idea, you know for sure. Other thoughts about this story?
It's not thoughts as much as questions.
Uh-huh.
As I crunch my candy. But two parts. One, I'm not sure I understand how what is beneficial and what is harmful translates to the parts of the elephant. I mean, I know that's a literal question, but how, when the Buddha tells these people, you know, look for what's beneficial with the elephant, what does that mean?
Great, it's a perfect question. I think that this is why it's a considered reflective, you know, the story is more of a question itself, for us to reflect on and find answers for ourselves to exactly that kind of question. So for me to offer you it doesn't say the story. So I could offer you my interpretation, but maybe that's not really, that wouldn't be helpful for you if what we're doing is training in reflecting and coming to understandings for ourselves.
So, agreed. Then also, unless I talk to other people and work together, I'll never get the full elephant.
Yes.
So how do you inquire of other people without causing the friction, but still probe and learn, I guess.
Fantastic. If you're willing to go along with me, I hope I can give it a little example. As you asked that question, I felt that you were asking with a lot of sincerity. This was an important question for you. Would you share a little bit why this is an important question for you?
I would say it relates to the second part of the question.
Can you hold it a little bit close?
Oh, sure.
The mic is the best advice for all of you to know. If you hold it horizontally, it's designed to...
Uh-huh. That's better. So I have difficulty with determining beneficial and harmful for others versus myself. And that wanting to do what is beneficial for others, but sometimes not recognizing what is beneficial for myself or what is harmful for myself. So in that, trying to figure that balance out, it requires quite a bit of seeking and looking and talking and asking other people that seem to have some knowledge in this area. How to do that?
Well, I don't know if I did it exactly. I didn't do what you're asking for, but I did something else just now, which is maybe an important part of, for me, an important part of the kind of the approach to this. I appreciated, I felt that this was an important question for you. Respecting that, I asked you why. You came back with a response, and I was touched by your response. Oh, this person cares about others and cares about these issues. And so now, I don't have an answer for you exactly, directly, but I feel more connected to you. I feel like, oh, here's a wonderful person who has sincere interest in welfare of others and self and doesn't know how to find it but wants to find it. So I'm not offering you exactly the answer, but I'm offering you, that's one way you start. You try to find out what drives people, what's going on with people underneath, what's motivating them, what are the emotions and feelings and interests, and why is this important for them? And then bridges start being made because we're getting into the humanity of people rather than the abstract ideas. I'm looking over there on the stage because of my memory, not anybody up there, but my memory of someone sitting up there many years ago and saying, what does the Buddha teach about rebirth? Okay. So that's a kind of a big topic, and you know, I've done a lot of study of Buddhism, so I could give them a long explanation. This is what the teachings is, and they're in different interpretations and different schools of Buddhism. This school of Buddhism believes this. This one does that. Then there's teachers who have this idea, and then and I could go on that topic. But luckily, I didn't do that. What I did is I asked the person, "Why are you asking?" And the person said something like, my uncle died this morning. The person didn't really want to know about Buddhist idea of rebirth. The person was dealing with this loss from that day. And so then that was the real issue. And then we were connected. And then I could address him in a very different way than if I had just given him a dissertation on rebirth in Buddhism. I would have missed him. He probably would have glazed over. So to ask, so that's one way to get, to start learning from other people, and is to kind of find out what drives them, what moves them underneath the surface. And then you start getting the bigger picture. And then you might have a better way of understanding what's beneficial for them. Because what's beneficial and harmful, I don't think it's so good to have an abstract idea of what that is. But to have an idea of what it is because you know them personally in some ways, or taking the time to find out something about them, then things begin opening up. What do you think?
I'll have to think about that.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yes. Thank you.
My question was just sort of thinking about the people, each of the blind people who know part of the elephant, and like how you can kind of combine that information to know the entire elephant, because it seems like it's the elephant isn't just like a basket with a mortar and pestle attached. There's like a lot of like, there's a lot of processing that has to go into understanding how to turn these little pieces into a big picture, uh-huh. even if it's still not the whole thing. So I was just sort of wondering, like, what you think about if we're genuinely connecting with people and we're knowing little bits, how can we kind of intelligently combine those things into a more complete understanding?
We can't. I think you just implied it. There's never going to be a complete understanding. We can't know. We can't know it all. But I think that we can know more, mm-hmm. and we can know enough so that we don't cause you know obvious or intentional harm. We could do enough to benefit some people some way, you know, nicely. I don't have to know how the endocrine system works in the body to know that if someone is hungry, it's good to feed them. You know, so we don't have to know it all, but we do need to know something. So this idea of and the story doesn't really go into detail what benefit and harm is. There's probably some people you'd find out in California who if you ask them how can I benefit you, and they would say, tell me what the winning lottery ticket number is. You know, or is that really what it's about? You know, to have lots of money. The Buddha would say, no, that's not what's really beneficial. Actually, they've done studies of people who won the lottery, big prizes, and apparently a high percentage of them are more unhappy a year later than they were before they won the lottery. So, you know, to really understand what is really beneficial and what is harmful, and not everyone knows that. People have a lot of confusion about this. Lots of people are kind of pursuing well-being, happiness, in ways that are probably dysfunctional in our society. And probably, my guess, it's probably fair to say a high percentage of us here, include myself, have done it at least a little bit occasionally in this life, even if it was accidental. You know, thought you were pursuing what was helpful for you, beneficial, and turned out it wasn't. So it's to learn what is really beneficial and what is, you know, causes real harm is part of the learning that we do learn in Buddhism. And a lot of that can come from meditation practice, because the heightened sensitivity and attention we learn from meditation begins showing us the pathways and byways and processes of suffering and happiness, and where the deeper well-being, the deeper sense of wholeness can exist within us. That is not possible if we're living, you know, a frenetic life that's always busy and thinking that happiness is going to come by having, you know, you fill in the blank, so many different things people are pursuing. If we believe the advertisers, that's where happiness is found, is in their products, it's not going to work. How's that answer for you?
Thank you.
Is that so close enough?
Yeah.
I couldn't be complete.
Of course not.
Yes.
Just a comment. It just occurred to me that each of the blind people had their own experience growing up. They're not all the same blind people. So yeah. One person's interpretation of a mortar is different from another person's, or whatever description they gave. So everybody had an opinion based on their own experience, which for me means that we all are different based on our own upbringing. The lens that we look at things is based on how we learned it growing up. So
yes.
A lot of people have limited information and they make big judgments, which, you know, like you said, there's no right or wrong answer, but we also need to understand that, which is why I think what you said, talking to people, getting to know their background, getting to know them, will bring more connection.
Yes, I think completely. We learn a lot. Like, I think what you're saying is really wise, that people's background affects how they interpret this. So someone who grew up in a forest might say that the leg is a tree trunk. Someone who grew up in the city says it's a column or a pillar. Someone who grew up with elephants would have said, it's an elephant. Not an elephant leg. And so our backgrounds have some impact there.
One question I had is about, kind of similarly to the question you're asking, how does the elephant map onto kind of other aspects of the story, primarily like the Buddha analyzing the situation of the monks? So the monks are all arguing, and then the Buddha is able to like diagnose their problems as not really being able to understand harm versus benefit. Are we imagining the Buddha as not just like touching one leg of the elephant, and that like, does the Buddha possess some kind of ultimate wisdom beyond that metaphor? And I ask this because something I really struggle with is practically determining harm versus benefit. That seems like a really hard question to me, and I don't always know like if I should trust like someone who I see having enormous wisdom, or if they're also kind of stumbling in the dark.
So I think I understood you say that in Buddha and his emphasis on benefit and harm, why isn't that all just part of the elephant as well? And it doesn't really give us the full picture of everything. And I think it's true that what you're saying. But if what you're interested in is to live without suffering and to live without causing harm, what the Buddha is saying is enough of the elephant. If what you want to know is some larger cosmic truth of the universe, then the Buddha maybe is too narrow in his focus. And that's why some people feel like Buddhism is not quite a religion, because religions give great answers. And the Buddha just has something, this little thing that he does, which is the ending of suffering. And it's a little one, it's a little thing. And I think from a Buddhist point of view, there might be the other big questions and the other big things to discover about the universe are worthwhile to pursue, but after your suffering's ended. Have that as the baseline, as the bottom. Bring suffering to an end. And that's also very interesting because another conversation I had with someone was they wanted to know what happens after I die. And rather than answering the question, I asked them, what's motivating the question? And the person said, I'm afraid. And I said, what would happen if you resolved your fear and had no fear of death? And the person said, oh, in that case, I don't need an answer to my question. So our view about what are the important questions of life and what to pursue can change dramatically once we've done the task the Buddha is pointing to. And it still might be a narrow part of the total, but it's a pivotal one. I think of it's a pivot. And in the Buddhist kind of understanding, they call this pursuit of the ending of suffering as a noble pursuit, as a dignified pursuit. I think the Buddhists hold it up as one of the best things you can do for a life, and in this life, and then one of the best things you can do for others as well. So 21 years ago, it was 9/11, and so that was a pretty traumatic event, catastrophic event for this country, for the world, and at the time, and people were kind of in shock. And a few days after that big event, there were some people I knew who were going to go do a 3-month meditation retreat, 3 months silent retreat. And I thought, oh, they're probably thinking, how could they go on a silent meditation retreat when everyone is so challenged and our society has such huge needs? And, you know, I felt like we had to address this thing. And to go off for 3 months by yourself, see, maybe they think it's selfish or inconsiderate of the needs that our society now has. So I went up to them and said, you know, I'm concerned about what you're thinking about and what you know, given in the wake of 9/11. But I want to reassure you that what you're doing is a really important response. This is really important what you're doing in the context of the kind of suffering of 9/11, because there has to be some people who are diving into the depths of their own suffering to resolve it and become free, to really pull out the roots of our suffering in our psyche and our hearts, to really resolve it. Because unless some people can do it, maybe there's no hope at all. Then we're just it's too much just band-aids that we're doing, fixing things here and there. And if we really want people to be happy, really want people to discover freedom and profound peace, it's helpful to find it for ourselves first.
Thank you.
So these are my reflections today in responding to your questions. And I hope I don't offer them as the truth to argue about. But I hope that one of the things I was hoping to get across tonight was a life of reflection. And so I offered the story as an example of an exercise and there's a lot more we could stretch and explore in the story. And some of what we explore in the story is what the story evokes in us. And that's what we reflect on. And so a life of action, reflection, and a life of living, and then learning from what's happened, learning from our actions, the effects of our actions, to live a mindful, conscious, reflective life is part of, central to this Buddhist enterprise. And in doing so, you become your own teacher. May it be so. Thank you.